this deck is meant to spur a conversation rather than have it as a definitive set of ideas on the method. I'm speaking as someone who realizes that he knows just enough about the method to be dangerous and not apply it necessarily well. So those experts who are online, please feel free to use this as a way of sharing with others how things really work or concepts that may be useful in making it work. So on slide 2, the slides are numbered. They have little numbers in the lower right corner. It's named after a place in Greece because all of their knowledgeable people used to be from Delphi, or Delphi, depending on how you pronounce it. And so this, because the technique is based on reliance of an expert's evaluation rather than a calculation. So it's based on reliance on an oracle. And their interpretation of what a measure for a variable might be. And it's generally done in ranges from 1 to 10 or low to high. And in, if we go to slide 3, it's sometimes used for double variable situations to calculate another variable and generally populates grids like this where you have two ranges from very low to very high and you have variable X or variable Y, you'll end up with one of those points on the grid, which will be a Z number, which then you can apply in some other calculation. And if you go to slide 4, I introduced the example of one of the kinds of grids that's used in risk assessment, where you could do a consequence calculation by looking at the exposure and vulnerability of an asset to a hazard. And if it may have high exposure, but may be strong enough that it's not that vulnerable to that particular kind of hazard, or even under low exposure, it might be quite vulnerable. So that would govern where it would be, and the expert would make some kind of choice about how that would work. And if you go to slide 5, the answer from that one, the consequence value, could go into another grid where you're actually measuring consequence against probability to get a risk measure. And again, there would be choices about what the probability levels would be. You've already made a stab at the consequence level, so you just plug that in relative to the probability, and you would get a risk number. So that's generally the sort of style of how it's used. In slide 6, for the rest of this presentation, sort of to stimulate conversation, hopefully it goes fairly quickly, I've picked a research paper, and the reference is there. It was written for engineers in construction and engineering on how they could use the Delphi method in their work. And the nice thing about this paper is it walks through a bunch of the issues associated with the use of the method and gives some tips about how to compensate for them. So there's inherent bias in any evaluation that doesn't rely on a pure calculation, and they talk about those. And if I could just stop here, and then why would you need a Delphi method as opposed to a calculation method? They cover that a bit in their introduction, and if you hadn't noticed, that paper is also available for download off the same site, so you can look at it as we go. There are times when it's either too complicated or we just don't have the full suite of information necessary to be able to run a rigorous calculation on something, and yet you need an answer. And this is quite common in risk assessment, where we have up to 57 different kinds of hazards that people need to deal with. There's presently not a rigorous calculation method for determining the risk of all of those. So people rely quite heavily on the Delphi method to be able to use experts in coming up with their best interpretation of the different variables involved with these hazards and the potential consequences from them, to be able to come up with some measure of the risk for each one of those. So it's the most typically used way. Although there are many different ways to do it, and we heard from, already lost his name, but a researcher at the University of the Okanagan, Solomon Tesfamarian, sessions back in this user group on his application for earthquakes. And I did hear a beep earlier, and I wondered if someone else joined.
Yes, Eric Wright in Ottawa. Sorry I was late.
No problem, Eric. Glad you could make it.
Thanks.
So I'm flipped to slide 7. And yeah. Slide 7 is a recast of one of the diagrams in that paper. And essentially their flowchart on making one of these Delphi evaluations. And the blue part there is the setup for getting it going. And Heather and Clarence, I know, have gone through this type of thing and worked through it. And they'll have a sense of how some of this works or doesn't work. Anyway, identify the question. You have to identify potential experts, figure out a way of selecting which ones are pertinent or have the right expertise to answer your problem, and then validate that, and then set up your whole questionnaire in a way which is going to ensure that you get an answer you want from those experts and to be able to plug in to your calculations. And in this case, you can see a loop in the sort of yellowish component. These authors recommended that you may need anywhere from 2 to 4 rounds of calculations with these experts to come to a consensus on a particular value. And they explain how to do that, and I'm not going to go through it, but you'll see in the lower right corner that says target consensus achieved. So if you've gone through these loops and the authors describe a certain variable range, which they would consider you've reached consensus in, and I think it's like a 1 in 10 spread or something, then you would reach consensus and then you would have a value and you could report that result. So that's their recommended loop. And in slide 8, they lay out essentially 9 characteristics, but really 4 of them are part of that loop process. And so I've just listed those as a way of stimulating our thinking. Again, identifying who the experts are, qualifying them, setting a preferred number, establishing a number of rounds you need to be able to get the answer, and then the choice you make on how you measure consensus. You also need a methodology for when you would do another round or not. And on slide 9, they write a few recommendations on how to identify potential experts, and this is particularly where I'm interested in feedback, in my understanding of how this works. Their example is particularly designed for research engineering, and in that sense, is it really applicable to some of the things that are done in community risk evaluation? So be interested in that. Under qualifying panelists as experts on slide 10, they also give a big list of how they qualify, and they recommend that you have 4 of these criteria for an expert, and you can see it's quite academic based. And the question is, are only academics able to really make, are they the only experts in the world and for particular situations, and if so, why, and so on. I'd be interested in your feedback there as well. 11, they give a number of panelists that they think should be coming up with a single answer, a And they have quite a few, 8 to 12. Slide 12, they talk about the number of rounds and how that works and how you measure consensus. And you can see that their consensus range is that you need a value difference of less than one-tenth of the range of possible values to be able to reach consensus. And then in slide 13, they list in their paper a bunch of the different human foibles people have which influence answers. And you can see that there's quite a few. I don't know if they've covered them all. I'm not an expert in this. But they talk about things being judgment-based as opposed to your experience or expertise in calculating different things. They talk about the collective unconscious, which is essentially everybody starts converging towards a number because it's the thing of the day. It's essentially the bandwagon situation. They talk about the contrast effect, which is the influence of your picking of your value dependent on the values that you've just picked before that. In other words, if you're giving a bunch of high ranges to something and then your next value ends up being a high range too, just because you're in that ballpark. And so that's called a contrast effect. Neglect of probability, which is interesting because I'm not sure how it works. They gave an example where a person is given $4. They're said, if you give me $4 and I won't zap you, but there's a 25% chance that I will, someone will pay the $4. But if they raise the ante to $10 and say, well, you have to pay me $10, there's a 99% chance that I'll zap you, people won't pay the $10. Because the difference of understanding what the probability changes are relative to the actual event, people have trouble with. There's the Van Restorff effect. It's essentially preferential memory of extreme events. So you just remember the worst thing that happened. You don't remember all the other stuff. The my side, which is essentially something I fall into quite a bit. I have to watch myself all the time, which is I start expressing an opinion about something, and then I feel I own it, and so I have to defend it and live with it instead of realizing that it is opinion-based and it's not that particularly rational, and if I had listened to all the rational arguments around me, I might not have held that opinion. But since I've opened my mouth, I feel like I'm stuck with it. Then there's the recency thing, which is the last thing that happened influences you. So that becomes the way you measure something is based on that instead of the longer range thing. They talk about primacy, which is rating higher those items that you evaluated first. So if you need to rate a whole bunch of stuff in your system, in your Delphi analysis, and you're doing them one by one, the first one gets a high rating and you tail off after that just because you become numbed. And then there's dominance, which is in a group anywhere from 8 to 12, as they were talking about, for a panel, someone might dominate the whole thing. And their personality just takes over and it influences everybody's decision, and after a while everybody just gives up and says, fine, we'll put it like that and we'll just move on because we have to move on. Now, those are the ones they list. All of them I can relate to. They give ways of dealing with them, and I'm not going to cover those because I'm hoping that will come out in our discussion. So I'll stop there. I'll open it up and we'll go from there. And I guess what I'd I'm interested in people who have used it and experienced it, and whether these things resonate with them, and whether they feel that they have enough knowledge to be able to just go ahead and dive into these, or essentially their experience on whether it's complicated or not.
It's Murray here.
Yeah.
I'll defer to Clarence and Heather for their sharing their experiences with using the methodology. But just wanted to say that we've used that methodology in a number of case studies and found it to be extremely effective in a variety of situations where there's a lack of objective information with respect to natural hazard risk. It can be a very effective tool. It also is extremely useful and probably one of the most effective means of getting at the subjective measures of risk in a community-based risk assessment. And, you know, it's used widely in other fields as well with very good results. So I think it's a very sound methodology, and it certainly has been tested in other disciplines quite well. And one of the things that I think, we often overlook is that the methodology can be linked to a spatial component. So, and this has been used in a number of risk assessments where you use the Delphi method and community mapping together to identify, areas of interest or concern, and use the Delphi method to essentially do your ranking. The outputs are essentially indicators, and they can be used in the way that analytic or numeric indicators are used. So a very, very powerful technique, I think, based on my own experience with it and from what I've read.
All right, thank you. Anyone else?
Bert?
Yeah.
It's Clarence here. So I was just going through some of your slides. So what Murray says, yes, it is very effective. One of the, limitations that work based on our HRB in Metro Vancouver is one of your slides, you suggested maybe 8 to 12 panels or people that would be part of that process. For our workshops, some workshops we had between 50 to 60 panels, I guess. I'll say we had way more than what was recommended, which is 8 to 12. So that was one of our challenges. I think smaller the better, or the discussions are just going to get way too big. So kind of got that over. Also, another thing is rounds 1, 2, or 3. One of the things that we had was that sometimes we would go 2 rounds and reach consensus, say at 50 or 55. One of the things that we should do is stick to it. So if we want to reach consensus at 50, or sorry, at 55, and we only do 2 rounds, and after 2 rounds, we don't achieve that, we move on. Just capture what was scored at that point rather than trying to make it fit trying to dominate the conversation and then make everybody vote to 55 until we reach consensus. So again, that was one of our lessons learned from that also.
How did you deal with the outliers?
Well, that's the one thing is every time we had an outlier, say everybody like a bell curve, and say we had like 2 outliers on either end, we would kind of vote and try to bring them in for a second round voting, and if it still showed on the outside, then we would only focus where the median is and say, okay, people, what do we need? What type of conditions do we need to kind of persuade your vote to get to the 55%? That's the not the process, but that was an approach that was used after when we didn't reach those consensus.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I'm making any sense, but.
Yeah.
Again, this is a very new technique to me, but learning as we go, just from watching some of your slides here, it does make sense to kind of follow the methodology and kind of stick with it. So rather than changing it on the fly, so that's kind of one of our things that came, sort of lessons learned again.
All right.
But there was also a lot of positive things where this type of technique, it did foster a lot of discussion from all across 50 to 60 people, everybody from engineers to fire to police, all the way down to the border trade representative. So there was a lot of good discussion. So some of the discussion people would just keep on getting a little more into the details.
Yep.
So that was one of the good things about this technique or this methodology, the Delphi technique. So
they mentioned that in their research paper as well, that the discussion component was very useful in
yes.
translating through the rounds, particularly,
yes.
and because it helped the rational thinking.
Yeah, so it was definitely very good when we went through all 52 or 54 of our scenarios. But looking at your slide 13, just looking at some of the biases, judgment, collective unconscious, there's my side, supremacy, dominance. Like, we did have a few of those personalities that were in the crowd. So
yep.
that was tough to manage in a panel of 50 to 60 people. So
the other key aspect that I think we experienced was inconsistency. So although we did our best to ensure that we had a consistent panel group of subject matter experts for each of the hazard types, there was, there were some different participants of the wider audience for each of the hazards. And so their understanding of the process and the system were not necessarily the same as the previous group. So again, we found ourselves, I guess inconsistency in two ways. Inconsistency in the understanding, interpretation, and education of the process, and inconsistency in the approach to their voting. So, at the end of the day, when you're using this methodology for doing a hazard risk assessment, where if your objective at the end of the day is not only to discuss and identify, the severity of the events and the impacts, if at the end of the day you're actually wanting to come up with a ranking, this is where I'm not yet convinced, unless you had just the set group of 8 to 12 people throughout the entire process, it makes it very difficult to compare results of one hazard type to another hazard type when you've got inconsistent voting.
Okay. And is that because you had different experts for different hazards?
Partially, because you're right. I mean, the experts for natural hazards are not the same as the experts that you'd bring in for terrorism and chemical biological events. So you're quite right. You have to bring in those subject matter experts, which that's what kind of drove the varying audience. No matter what, though, we still tried to have, and perhaps what we should have done is not necessarily included those subject matter experts in the actual voting. Instead, utilize them to present the case and to address the consequences and all the main issues, and just rely on the same 8 to 12 people who represent the emergency response family to a certain extent, and those same 12 people should have been the only ones who did the voting for all five hazard types, because then you would have had more consistency in the understanding of the process itself. But we included the subject matter experts in the ranking for each of those hazards. So this is where things got skewed just a little bit, and it was a bit more difficult to, at the end of the day, come up with, your top list of, say, if your goal was to identify the top 12 ranking hazards that would cause the greatest impact to this region. We feel that we've still successfully achieved that, but I can't necessarily say that the rankings from the voting drove that. Instead, we had to really go into more detail analyzing the answers to each of the questions, which took a lot more time and a lot more effort on our part.
Okay.
Bert, it's Murray here, just with a couple of other ideas and
yep.
angles. The context in which you use Delphi is also very important. So it can be used as a very, very effective tool in community-based risk assessment to gather the input you need from a selected group of individuals to characterize the perception of risk in the community. And that often is done at the very beginning of a risk assessment that may also include you know, the use of domain experts and possibly the use of quantitative methods of risk assessment. It's very effective in gauging what people's understanding of risk is in a community. In some cases, it might be very close to what the domain experts understand to be the risk in a community and very close to what modeling might suggest. But in other cases, particularly where people haven't had the experience of hazard events in their community, there can be a wide gap between what people understand and or what community members understand and what domain experts might understand. And that can be the jumping off point for a very, very rich discussion about the black swan event for events that people don't really think about. So it's very effective in engaging and engaging the perception of risk. So that's one point I wanted to raise. It can also and often is used in conjunction with analytic methods or in conjunction with the use of domain experts for a semi-quantitative assessment. The other thing that we found was it's really important to have both individual and group responses. And again, the differences between the individual responses and the group response brings out some of the points that you raised in your slide about dominance and some of the other effects. So if you can actually summarize those individual responses and bring them back to the group in the context of the session, it can serve as a very, very good grounding for a group discussion about why there are differences and help have some of those sticking points. So just a few lessons learned from our application of the method.
Murray, it's Clarence. Is there another method that is very similar to the Delphi technique that you're aware of?
Well, there's lots of variations on it, as you probably know. So, I mean, I know it, as the Delphi methodology, but it's risk appraisal is used, is another word that's used, and methods, very similar are used throughout Europe in both risk assessment field, but also in environmental assessment and sustainability planning. Very, very similar methodologies. You know, they're called slightly different things, but the root of the method and some of the characteristics of the method that Bert's outlined are very similar.
So that may be a misconception on my part. I don't know. I made an interpretation that if you use an expert for their judgment and evaluation as opposed to an actual calculation, that it ends up being Delphi. And so I lumped them all in that giant class. I'm not sure if they're subclasses. But
Bert.
Sorry, go ahead.
Maggie here. I just wanted to also offer an observation and perhaps a way to use a process like the Delphi method more along the lines of the realistic situation that Clarence and Heather experienced, which is that they were hoping for, ultimately the group deciding, coming to some consensus or deciding on the priority list. But perhaps that's kind of the ultimate goal, but there could be an intermediate goal where, in the absence of using this technique, you are back to a few professionals sitting at their desk, having to make these decisions by themselves, which is what we've heard from one of the partners that we've been working with, is they don't feel very comfortable doing that on behalf of the whole community. So using a Delphi method more as an information gathering or somehow educating or informing that the person, let's say, in the government who ultimately needs to make some priorities, perhaps it would be useful in that, so you don't get actual, making it to the end, but it helps to inform the person whose job it is to do something about these hazards, and they have to proceed. So I think there's still value in getting informed by people's opinions. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
I think it's related. It sounds like it's related to what Murray was saying in terms of perception gathering as a educational tool. I'm not sure, but
so does that aspect help Heather and Clarence in the type of work that you're doing, instead of aiming at getting this prioritized by the group that you've collected, seeing it more as a information gathering?
Well, no, I totally agree with you, Maggie. I think it definitely, you know, I'm not convinced that really at the end of the day it's necessary to have like a ranking. We seem to really draw significant importance on, from both a critical infrastructure perspective and from a hazard risk assessment, having some sort of priority list. But really, at the end of the day, isn't it more important that we've discussed all the impacts, the consequences, the issues of concern, our, the response capabilities, going right into the recovery issues? I think maybe that's more important. And I think through having those discussions, you will ultimately still come out with, these are our worst-case scenarios, maybe not so much a ranking, but more or less your worst-case scenarios that you need to ensure that your plans address. So I do agree. I certainly please don't want people thinking that I'm discounting the methodology or the process. Clearly, we could have done things differently and improved the process. As Clarence was just saying, perhaps if we had done some education on the whole Delphi methodology before even entering into this, that might have given people a better perception. In fact, never even when the CBP process was introduced to us was it even directly linked back to Delphi.
Yeah.
And I think that would have probably helped us in the long run if that had been identified and if we had maybe done a wee bit more education up front on the methodology and process before entering into it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I should open the opportunity for a few others. I don't know if Doug or Tyler or Dale or Chris or so on would like to throw something in here.
I think it's Doug. I think Clarence and Heather covered it very well. I think what I found important, and this just is the fact, the education in watching the people in the various tables get a better understanding of the issues that they perhaps hadn't thought would impact their agencies.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we all seem to like to have numbers, and that, for some reason or other, makes them more important when they are a rating.
All right.
I think that's where the Delphi method somehow is trying to introduce that, yet keep the more subjective elements part of the process.
No, I agree with you, Doug. It's Clarence. I think that's one of the strengths of the Delphi technique. It's not so much of a numerical ranking of 1, 2, 3, 4 of your hazards, but almost grouping them into just categories and just let the results fall where they should fall without actually assigning numbers.
Interesting. Chris, do you have anything on this? Lost him with the mute button. How about David?
Nothing for me either, Bert.
No? You guys use any of these kinds of things in Esri?
Not to my knowledge. I'm not necessarily the techie to be asking that question, though.
All right.
afraid.
No problem. How about you, Eric? Quiet. Tyler?
Nothing for me at this time, thanks.
How about Lisa?
Nothing for me either, thank you.
All right. I got everybody. How about Dale?
Yeah, nothing. I got nothing. I've not really seen a technique being used around here. They just sit around and make their decision.
Interesting. Well, it's kind of like sitting around and making decisions, but in a process way, I guess.
I don't know. I haven't seen it being used that way. I mean, I haven't seen them use this particular technique.
Okay. One of the things that I was impressed with in this particular paper was they had listed a bunch of solutions to deal with some of the biases. So I would be interested in knowing whether applications that you're familiar with actually incorporated things like that, or whether it was dealt with on a one-on-one basis.
Bert, could you repeat that again?
Well, in the list of biases that Hallowell and Gambetti's come up with in their paper, they also list some ways of dealing with those biases, and so and they become actual methodologies in the system. In other words, they're built in right away as a way of countering what is a known bias. So I was wondering if you're aware in your application whether that was done.
It's Doug here. If not having read the paper, I find it difficult to answer that. My initial look at the biases that are there suggests it's almost a combination of who's ever facilitating the meeting ensuring that there is a balanced approach, and adding to that the actual way the process moves forward. In other words, what is the material that is put out in advance, or how it's presented?
Yep.
So I look forward to reading more, Bert, about what they've said, because pardon me, if we look at the Restorff, or however you correctly pronounced it, that is such a human trait that I don't know how you deal with that bias.
Well, I'm not sure if they have one for that one either. I don't remember that. But I was reading one, for instance, that they had one for people who were influenced by recent events. So, for instance, if you're an expert but you've just been on a construction site where you've experienced either a catastrophe, like the bridge fell down or whatever, the researchers here say make sure that person's not part of your expert panel, because their bias level is just going to be too great. So you need to do pre-filtering right away to get rid of that bias by essentially looking in your questionnaire of the expert whether they've essentially have that recency effect or not. And that would be one.
That seems quite an extreme. I think one with a professional normally just brings up the issue and lets the professional then almost reminds the professional that they have to be the professional they are, and so they take that into account in their contribution as a subject matter expert.
You see, that was the interesting thing about reading this paper, from my view, was and its contrast to our discussion is these guys are particularly keen on getting a number. And the best number. In other words, a scientifically defensible number. They're not interested in the educational component. They're not interested in the learning component, the community analysis kind of thing. They need a number. And so I think their process is built completely around that concept as well, which is what, you know, I'm really glad to hear these other things coming out.
Bert, it's Murray. I'd be happy to follow up, you know, at some point if there's interest. There's been a lot learned in other disciplines that I think, you know, we could benefit from. The method has been used a lot in environmental assessment, both as an appraisal technique, that is, in a community setting where you're really trying to get a sense of people's understanding and the purpose is to elevate or structure a discussion to support learning and understanding amongst members of the community about an issue where judgments may vary or, that is, subjective judgments may vary or values may vary quite a lot. So the other, you know, there's some good references that I'd be happy to pass along to the group. There's an excellent one, 2002 by Yeo. The method is the basis for a trade-off analysis in environmental planning. And he's written a guidebook for how to do this that was used there. My understanding is that it is used by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as the basis for their multi-criteria decision analysis process that they go through with communities. So there's a lot of good information there, and just looking at some of the biases, the things that may bias Adelphi process, I recall that the report does try and address some of those, so there may be some good ideas in that guidance document by Yeo. And again, happy to pass along those references if people are interested. The spatial component, I'm going to hammer again. I think people often forget that you can tie Delphi to community mapping, and it becomes extremely powerful as a way of reflecting back to either community members or to a group of domain experts, both what they're saying at the individual level and what they're saying as a group. And it really helps frame a discussion about differences of opinion or differences in judgment or differences in understanding. So very, very effective.
Just to make sure I understand that one correctly, is it akin to community map building where you're making assessments as a group on where boundaries are to particular aspects, spatial aspects?
Yeah, in many cases, you know, particularly when you're asking questions about vulnerability or you know, hazard potential, they are, or capability even, they're very often spatially reference questions. Like, people have an idea about who and what are vulnerable in a community, but they also know where they live and where the features are that are vulnerable. And so in addition to getting a, you know, just a general sense of vulnerability, if you tie their assessment of vulnerable assets, let's say, to a map and ask them to actually identify areas on the map, you gain so much more information out of the Delphi process than just asking a generic question and coming up with a number at the end of the day that is often, as people have mentioned, it's often very difficult to interpret what that number means or what people are trying to communicate with that number.
Right. Okay.
So it's a way of making the rankings evident, spatially evident to people.
Hey, Murray. I think late last year, I think Esri hosted some sort of a community mapping kind of seminar, I believe, downtown. I'm not sure if it was in November or December, about community mapping. Did you attend that?
I did not, Clarence.
Okay, because I wonder if they introduced the Delphi technique of talking about, like what you said, like emergency management, hazard risk, and all that, in using the spatial component rather than just asking one question, but kind of foster a discussion using this Delphi technique. I think that would maybe help the end users, whoever uses the community mapping online tool.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what was covered in that session. You know, the general field of multi-criteria decision analysis uses the Delphi method quite a bit, and
yeah,
they make it spatial. So I think, you know, some great lessons to be learned from that field of research. And The other thing I would say is that this is a method that's very often used in a community planning process. Community planners use this on a routine basis, in mostly in their strategic planning operations, like if in, around social community plans or any kind of strategic community planning process. They're often, you know, very highly skilled planners who are facilitating workshops involving both domain experts and community members, using this methodology to try and get at a sense of shared understanding and how to move forward if there are differences in terms of judgments.
David, are you still online? I asked because David's local rep here with Esri and may have a story about that. I'll check with him later.
It's Doug. Just one question for Murray. I'm just looking at the engineer's report and the table 5, which talks about some of the things that you can do to reduce the biases.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested, Marie, in the other research that you've done, if there's similar issues have come up and what the suggestions are for dealing with those. So perhaps offline over the next few weeks, we could have a discussion on that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, because it's certainly, you know, a methodology that every time it's applied, you learn something, and sharing what we're learning from the application of these methods, particularly in this field, I think is really, really important. So I'd be happy to do that. I'm looking at the table, and you know, the only other thing I can think of to add in there is that to minimize the effects of uncertainty in the assessment, one thing that I've seen used a lot is, instead of asking for a specific number, asking for a range. And that range of numbers, like a minimum, maximum, so that you're giving people almost a slider bar on an indicator and asking them to, you know, slide the bar over to where they think it is, but show also the bounds of uncertainty in their response. That's another method that's been used to address some of the these issues of bias. Especially effective when you then compare the individual responses that you get using that method to what the overall group response is.
Yeah, it's almost the opposite of anonymity.
Yeah.
and that I find that those are very good comments, because just excludes somebody for a specific reason as opposed to try to work with them so that they, along a continuum, can rank their own biases and then use that as the baseline, seems like a much more effective way of using people's talents.
Yeah, I think it's just to build on a comment that Bert made, you know, often the method is used because there isn't a quantitative methodology available, and so the focus is on getting a number and a defensible number that can be used in decision making. That's often the rationale that's used. And so, you know, as with any scientific method, you try and minimize the uncertainty, and you frame the process in such a way that you get the answer that you need, a defensible answer at the end of the day. And while I think that might be valid in many applications, often you're not gathering the really rich information that you need to support a decision-making process, which is often, you know, what is the uncertainty and how much ambiguity is there surrounding a decision. And that's almost as valuable as the number at the end of the day, is understanding what the level of uncertainty and ambiguity is.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back to Heather and Clarence's comments about the education aspect of the whole process.
Yeah.
We're nearing the end. I would like to offer that if anyone has a reference, that they think might be useful to others. If they send it to me, I will post it on the user group site so others have access to it. Is there any final contributions people would like to make?
Thank you, Bert. That was a very good PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, thank you, Maggie. I found it a useful paper, and I've been struggling with this concept, and so I thought I'd help others struggle with me. All right. Thank you very much for participating. I learned lots. I hope others got something out of it, and we'll catch you again in a month.
Thank you, Bert.
Thanks, Bert.
All right.
Thank you, Bert.